Hello, and welcome to the Weekly Comic Spotlight on the Comic Book Page podcast. My name is John Mayo.
And I'm Bob Breitall. In this episode, we'll be discussing recently released comics. One from DC, one from Marvel, and at least one other. As always, we'll keep major spoilers to a minimum, but we'll discuss general plot points and storylines of the comics we review.
This is Weekly Comics Spotlight 266 for comics originally released on September 12th, 2012. I was going to say 11 there, but no, it's 2012. We're in the zero month for DC, and our DC book is Team 7 Number 0. Now, Team 7 is a kind of a classic Wildstorm group. It featured, at that point, kind of the parents and precursors of Gen 13. Now, did you pick this one up? You were going to pick this one up in the store
I was going to pick it up. I was on vacation, and American Airlines conspired to prevent me from ending up being able to pick it off by canceling my flight back from Washington, and I ended up not getting back until after the comic shop closed. I was supposed to get back 2 or 3 hours before the comic shop closed, stop at the comic shop on my way home, pick up some books, and be all set, but that did not happen.
Fair enough. I, of course, pre-ordered this, got this, read this. I really question the wisdom of reusing Team 7, the name, because it kind of branded this, I think, in a lot of people's mind as potentially a Wildstorm-based title, which I really don't think was going to help sales.
That's exactly why I chose not to pre-order it.
Yeah. Well, if you think about the last couple of years of Wildstorm, it was in a downward spiral where it was just revectoring every 6 to 8 months. You know, the World Without End stuff, a bunch of things. And some of it was really good, some of it not so much. But it had a sense of desperation there at the end, which I think kind of tainted some of the titles and properties. Which is why when they came out with Voodoo and Grifter and Stormwatch, I'm like, okay, that's interesting. And I don't know that, well, I mean, Stormwatch, I think, has been accepted okay, but the other two, I don't think are widely regarded as some of the best New 52 titles. And then when they came out with this Team 7 and stuff, it was, it's interesting because it's a fairly even mix of DC characters, Wildstorm characters, and a couple of new characters. And we get basically, you know, 5 years ago, as the heroes are coming out, John Lynch, actually, who was kind of the Nick Fury of the Wildstorm universe, kind of, sort of, he is having some meeting with some higher-ups that we never see, saying, these heroes have come out, only a handful now, but gosh, in 5, 10 years' time, who knows how many there will be. We need something to deal with this. And he assembles Team 7. And this issue is basically a lot like that Before Watchmen Minutemen number 1 that we talked about a couple of weeks back, where you get a couple of pages as each of the different characters is getting recruited. And I think that was kind of a smart move because it made it feel like a lot happens in this issue. And, you know, a fair amount does. And really, for any particular character, they're only in there for a couple of pages for the most part. And we get enough to get what their role is expected to be in the series. Whether it turns out that way or not, I don't know. But the selection of characters I thought was interesting. Lynch is kind of the coordinator, assembler of the team, and handler of the team. Kind of makes sense. We get Dinah Drake, of course, you know, Black Canary. We get Kurt Lance, which I found very interesting. He is the partner of, you know, the future Black Canary. And at this point, different last names, not married. There is a comment in, I think it was Birds of Prey number 10, where Black Canary refers to, you know, her husband when he died and stuff. So presumably Kurt Lance is going to marry her.
It was Larry Lance in the previous continuity, right?
Exactly. That's what I was just going to point out. Is pre-crisis, the husband of the Earth 2 Black Canary was Larry Lance, not Kurt Lance. And I'm kind of curious why the change there. Hey, why not just be Larry Lance?
It's kind of like the David Banner instead of Bruce Banner kind of a thing. You kind of look at it and say, what exactly is the motivation for doing this?
Well, with that, that was for the TV show.
No, but I mean, sure. It's like, it's a name, right? It's kind of like, why don't you just use the right name? I always figured that.
Yeah, I mean, to me, you get a little more latitude when you've got another group coming in to adapt for a TV or a movie or something like that, because it's for a different audience. For the comics, you're right, there's no reason to change the name. Now, we also get Deathstroke, Slade Wilson, and this is pre-Deathstroke. And it's interesting because this issue very much covers the assembly of Team 7 and, you know, ends off with the team assembled about to go on their first mission, you know, which is, you know, the next blurb at the end is, you know, Mission 1, Prison Break-In. Okay, that's going to be their first mission. Got it. But over in Deathstroke number 0 that also came out this week, we get, you know, a really quick, you know, page or two about Team 7, because it's, you know, obviously a big deal in Deathstroke's history. And the take there is kind of an uneasy alliance about covert operatives and stuff, which I didn't really feel there was any uneasy alliance aspect here. It's just they're all assembled. Okay, great. And the first mission they get there doesn't seem to be a prison break-in kind of... It seemed like there was a bit of out-of-syncness between this creative team and Rob Liefeld on Deathstroke Zero. So probably best to just kind of ignore that aspect of Deathstroke Zero. But other characters we get here, we get Alex Fairchild, father of Caitlin Fairchild, who we're seeing over in Superboy and Ravagers, Cole Cash, Grifter, Amanda Waller, leader of the Suicide Squad. But then we get a couple of new characters. James,
it's skinny Amanda Waller, right? Like we've seen in...
like who's in Suicide Squad, like Squad, I just said,
right.
Yes.
Yeah.
I think they just have the one Amanda Waller. I mean, she has a grandmother.
Yeah, Green Lantern movie Amanda Waller.
Or New 52 Amanda Waller.
Yeah.
But yes, she's in there. And they're setting her up as having had a you know, tactical, you know, background in the Army and so forth. Dean Higgins is another new character who has apparently worked with Amanda Waller. We've got Summer Ramos, who seems to be like a pilot and stuff. She's in here, new character. And James Bronson, who's also a new character. And the new ones are kind of ill-defined, because again, they only get a page or two, you know, as they're getting recruited, and I don't know where they're going to go with those characters. And part of what's interesting about this is 5 years ago, modern day, we know what happens, we know where Amanda Waller is, we know where Grifter is, we know where Slade Wilson is, we know where Black Canary is. Some of these other characters that, you know, are new in this issue, do they die? What happens to them? Are they going to be some big threat that pops out of the woodwork? You know, who knows? But overall, I thought the art on this was really good. I thought the story was pretty good. It was a very good, you know, assemble the team story. But part of the problem with that is it does just that. Just assemble the team. So at the end of this, they're at the group shot of, hey, let's go on their first mission. And we really haven't seen them interact with each other yet. This does a much better job setting up this team than the couple of pages, like I said, in Deathstroke Zero. I'm looking forward to seeing where this goes. I thought it was a good read. Whether they needed to do this title, whether this title will catch on or not, I don't know. It's also interesting, Steve Trevor was mentioned as being one of the members of this team, and I saw no sign of him whatsoever in this issue. So I don't know where they're going with him, or if he's even going to pull into this team later or not. Presumably he will. So I thought this was a good read. I'd give it a 4 out of 5. I enjoyed it. I think a lot of people are going to skip this based on the, frankly, the name and the supposition. It'll have a lot more Wildstorm stuff in here than, it's got a fair amount, but not in a way that I think hurts the book.
But even what you're talking about, I mean, it seems to be tying into a lot of books that I'm not reading, so it has a limited appeal even without the Wildstorm angle.
Well, I think, at least for a while, this is going to be set 5 years ago. So it's not like it's going to be crossing over into the current stuff in Birds of Prey. It's dealing with Alex Fairchild, not Caitlin Fairchild, over in Ravagers.
Right, but I mean, it's got that connection to Ravagers. I'm not reading Ravagers. It's got a connection to Birds of Prey. I'm not reading Birds of Prey. You know, it's like there's these connection aspects. And I think that's something that DC's doing is like they've got these kind of corners of their universe where, I mean, at least for me, I've been opting out of chunks of the DC universe because of the way they have them tied together. It's almost like the X-Men universe at Marvel. You know, it's like, okay, well, I'm not going to get the X-Men universe. So there's a whole set of books, you know, which maybe it's not going to be the way that it is after Marvel now.
Well, I think the difference there is with like the X-Men books over at Marvel, they are so tightly integrated with each other. Things that are happening in one play out in another title a little later, and they're very intertwined. So to go on that basis and say, gosh, I'm going to skip Team 7 because it has a tangential connection to, you know, two or three books that are not going to make it an intertwined mess like the X-Men titles can be, I think is why a lot of people are going to skip this book and, frankly, why they should not skip it. Not to say they should go get it, but that, I think, is an invalid reason for skipping this book. It's a concern that I don't think is going to come to pass. I mean, there's nothing I read in here that made me think, wow, you know, and I could be totally wrong. We could be talking a year from now where Team 7 is the core book in a crossover between Birds of Prey, Ravager, Suicide Squad, you know, some of these other books. I really don't see that happening. You know, the fact that, I mean, this is years before Grifter becomes Grifter, before Deathstroke becomes Deathstroke, before Dinah Drake becomes Black Canary, before Amanda Waller starts up the Suicide Squad. So while there are those touch points, I think they're just to give a reference point, not to tie this into half a dozen different books. In other words,
I understand your point. I just look at it from the point of DC has a track record of doing those kind of tie-ins at what would seem like to be the first opportunity. So I would be personally, I'd be very surprised if a year from now, Team 7 was not in some crossover with those other books.
And you very well could be right. I just think that if you're looking for reasons to not get onto a book, there's always going to be some. And, you know, obviously that's one to be found. Time will tell if they cross it over or not. I'm hoping they don't, but yeah, you're right. Sooner or later they will. That's just the nature of the beast at DC. You know, we'll find out. But it just seems like if you go on that basis, there's virtually no title at DC that would be, you know, I guess, quote-unquote, safe to get.
I know.
You can't get the Superman books because, well, he's in the Justice League. You know, and there's Superboy, Supergirl, and you know, Action Comics. So, well, it'll cross over. I better not touch all of those. You know, likewise, anybody who's in the Justice League is therefore off-limits. You know, any book that's crossed over to any other book, that's off limits. Hell, I mean, they've already tied All-Star Western into the Batman family, Stormwatch to Demon Knights, iVampire to Justice League Dark. I mean, there is no totally self-contained book, I think. So, at that point, if you're so against that kind of cross-pollination, obviously the DC and Marvel universes are probably not the best places to be looking for titles to read.
Yeah, and I'm not looking at it in exactly that way. I'm more looking at it as, okay, taking the flip side, if I'm not looking for reasons to not buy Team 7, they didn't really give me a reason on the positive side to buy Team 7.
I think this book is geared towards appealing to people who want covert operatives, a more militaristic, almost a S.H.I.E.L.D. kind of equivalent, not quite as big as S.H.I.E.L.D., of course. But Nick Fury and a couple of commandos in a modern-day superhero setting. That's, I think, the feel they're trying to go for. Something that might have appealed to people who read or read Men of War, G.I. Combat, but want a much more superheroic aspect of it. People who liked Blackhawks.
So you should work for DC Marketing, John. Because if they had pitched it like what I took from the pitch for it was, hey, look, it's Amanda Waller from Suicide Squad, and here's Wade Wilson from Deathstroke, and here's, you know, and they pitched it, tying it to all these other books that I had no interest in. and thus I had no interest in this book.
Yeah, I mean, that's exactly
how they
pitched it.
Their marketing machine is not working to pitch books like this to me.
I agree entirely. I picked it up more because, frankly, it was there than because they pitched it well. And as far as anyone working for DC Marketing, I think you hit the nail on the head of not much is working at DC Marketing. Same at Marvel and stuff. I really think the corporate-owned publishing companies, mainly Marvel and DC, have lost touch with the readers. What they want, how they buy, you know, what turns them on, what turns them off. We've had a great discussion on the forum this past week about buying habits, you know, what works, what doesn't, you know, what turns people on and off and stuff. You know, what's the role of an editor? How strong should they be? In what ways should they be strong, etc.? And to me, Team 7's a great example of that. Had they given it a different name and a different pitch, I think the sales would have been twice what it probably was, not knowing what they were. Had they coordinated better with Deathstroke, they could have, you know, dovetailed readers between the books and cross-pollinated better. But as it is, I do think that essentially your standpoint of, I don't know, being put off, I was going to say scared off, but that's wrong, but being hesitant to get the book because of all of these, hey, it ties with this, it ties with that, it ties with this other thing. That's going to be the predominant viewpoint on this title, I think. And frankly, I don't know that it's going to last long enough to cross over with all those other books.
Well, I mean, I look at the solicits. I was looking at the solicits to the DC books last night, and I just pulled it up while we were talking. Team 7, number 3, the very first thing in the solicit is, from the pages of Red Hood and the Outlaws, the mysterious Essence joins the team's battle against the Heart of Darkness, known as the Black Diamond. You know, and it's just like, okay, here's another one. They're saying, okay, here, now you're going to see somebody from Red Hood and the Outlaws, which is a book I'm not getting.
You know, so but that's funny because out of all the books this ties into with these characters, that's not one of them.
Well, apparently now they're trying to tie it
that's
into
That's my
that
point,
franchise.
Though,
yeah.
Is I think they're trying to use this as a de facto spine book and be pulling in hooks from every other title out there. You know, we will probably get some connection to, you know, either Demon Knights or Stormwatch or Frankenstein and the Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. or something. Because the way they're trying to get readers these days is not by earning them by telling good stories, but by leveraging off other titles or sucking them in through solicitation that's frankly either misleading or flat out wrong. I don't know. I mean, it comes down to, yeah, I don't think they know how to market these books. All of that said, I thought it was a 4. I think most people are never going to see it and read it, so, you know, that's unfortunate. We'll see how well this book gets received, how the sales do, but it could have been a 5 out of 5 to everybody who read it, and I still don't think it would have picked up much in sales, just because I think the perceived Wildstorm connection, the perception of tied to too many other titles, the fact they're trying to tie it to yet even more titles, that works at cross purposes to getting the sales up.
It looks like they're pulling it into a crossover. This Black Diamond business. We got Demon Knights, Team 7, All-Star Western, and Catwoman all getting pulled into this Eclipso's Black Diamond and the Black Room. They're planting the seeds in the next solicit. So there you go.
Okay.
Crossover.
So, you were right, I was wrong, but the irony is, it wasn't with the expected titles.
I know, it wasn't. It's just like, oh, let's reach out these other places.
I think the number of crossovers DC's doing is really a bad move to do that many at once. Because they're doing Hell on Earth, Rise of the Third Army, Death of the Family, the Hawkman Hunted or whatever, Rot World. It's going to seem like every DC book is intertwined with everything else. And I think, like we talked about early on with DC, when everything was either at the beginning of a story arc, the middle of a story arc, or the end of the story arc, it's like there was that sense of sameness across the DC universe. I mean, I'm definitely feeling that right now where, like, every DC story I'm reading is an origin story. It's like, you know, I'm just not in the mood for that sometimes. Give me something else to where it's it may be a wonderful flavor to use in a dish, but if everything you're eating for the last week or two has that same spice, you get tired of it. That's what I think DC's doing right now. They're going to the same well too deep too often, and they need to be trying to differentiate some of their books, not tie them all in together.
Well, somebody said on the forum too, and I think this is an interesting point, is that, you know, the number of titles, you know, if DC was, and there were arguments on both sides, but if DC's tying a cohesive universe of 20 or 25 titles together, I might be compelled to want to read all of them. But when they're trying to tie a cohesive universe of 55 titles together or something, that's too many books, you know, and it's just like, how many books do most people want to get from DC? And if it's not this big, cohesive, giant chunk, might people just go in the other direction?
There's cohesive and there's intertwined. I think if they did a cohesive universe of 100 titles, this would be obviously totally ridiculous, and I'm not suggesting they do this, but if they had 100 titles where it was a seamless continuity that it was easy to migrate from book to book or whatever because the backdrop was consistent. Superman was always Superman and, you know, things like that versus, you know, not necessarily, but consistent, but not intertwined. Something to where each book stood on its own, but was clearly in the same cohesive world versus I'm reading two books this week, Team 7 and Deathstroke, that are touching on the first mission of Team 7 and they don't jive. Two books, 1 week. Come on.
Yeah, that's a fair point. I mean, I think the cohesion versus intertwined is a really good point you make, because it's kind of like the consistency versus continuity argument. You know, I want things to be consistent. I don't necessarily need to have really deep, you know, in the weeds continuity between everything, but I need Batman to act like Batman, you know, kind of things. And it's, you know, if these things are consistent across a cohesive universe, that's good. When you have everything told in story form such that they're leading you to believe that you need to read these things that you don't necessarily want to read in order to understand a story, then that's not a good thing.
Yeah, they should be encouraging you to read more because it's more of the same great quality you expect, not kind of forcing you to read more to get the full story and understand what the heck's going on. That's where I think they're going wrong. You know, if you don't read certain books, you don't understand, you know, other ones. And that to me is integrating the books too tightly, intertwining them in a bad way. But fairly common.
Yeah. Fair enough.
Shall we move on to our Marvel book, which is Avengers Assemble number 7?
Sure.
Now, this was another one you didn't make it out to go get.
That's correct.
Because you're kind of off the Avenger books right now.
Yeah, but this one feels like it's almost a different continuity or something. I mean, I've been picking up the last couple of issues of this off the rack that had like the Guardians of the Galaxy and stuff. And it almost, I mean, it doesn't feel like it's the same team that is in the other books. Or, you know, I mean, it's like more like the movie kind of characters, and I don't know. It just seems different.
It's the selection of characters from the movies. It's clearly, though, in the Marvel Universe. That having been said, it's also currently not intertwined with the Avengers versus X-Men and other core continuity books. So where exactly this fits in that timeline is a little unclear, but it does fit there. They're trying to have their cake and eat it, too. They want something that people coming off the movie would say, oh, I know these characters, these are the Avengers, and make sense. Not sucking them in or forcing them into all of the Avengers versus X-Men chaos, not intertwining it like that, yet still being a Marvel Universe book. So they're walking a fine line there, or at least trying to. This is Bendis and Bagley. They, of course, had this epic run on Ultimate Spider-Man. And I found this issue very interesting because you can split it into two halves very easily. There's the part of it, and not even halves, but two aspects of the issue. There's Thanos facing off against the Elders of the Universe. That's kind of the opening sequence, and the closing page touches on that. And then you've got the Avengers and the Guardians of the Galaxy fighting the Badoon or whatever. And the issue, the last issue had ended with, one of the Badoon soldiers tripping an airlock and the Avengers are getting expelled out into space. Now, for certain Avengers, this is a big deal. For other Avengers, not so much. You know, it's funny because this was used, I feel frankly, as a stalling tactic by Bendis to fill out most of the issue. I mean, I like the part with Thanos. The other part, not so much. You know, frankly, getting expelled out into the cold, harsh vacuum of space and it taking a little bit of time for Black Widow to basically finish sending off a fairly lengthy SOS message back to S.H.I.E.L.D. and getting out to help people. By which point, frankly, Hawkeye, who's got just his regular costume on, it looks like, should be dead. Now, in fairness, it looks like he died and they brought him back. Because, well, the Guardians of the Galaxy, I guess, have magical, mystical, you know, undead through the cold, harsh vacuum of space powers of some sort. The part that bothered me was Iron Man also seemed to be really taken out of action by this. He's in a suit of armor with his own air supply. How the heck did this face him at all?
Of all of the ones that shouldn't be affected by this, it should be Iron Man. You know, that's a little crazy. Okay.
I mean, I'm okay with, I guess it was Black Widow, getting a little oxygen to the Hulk and to Thor and getting them going. Okay, that's fine. I can buy them surviving in space. I'm even willing to give them a little bit of leeway with the super soldier serum, which they reference, making it possible for Cap to survive. But this other stuff, it just didn't work for me. You've got the vacuum of space aspect, meaning, well, let's not put any dialogue in for a couple of pages here and there. It just felt like it dragged on a little too much. It was a bit nonsensical in all the wrong ways for me, for who was impacted, how long it took to get Tony back in action, stuff like that. And it's not a horrible issue, but it's one of those that just it didn't click with me for most of the issue. Factor in the it's off on its own little side continuity from the other Avenger books. Factor in the solicit was that the Avengers are hot on the heels of Thanos, trying to stop his quest for intergalactic power, but when the Mad Titan has a cosmic cube in his possession, Earth's mightiest will have to team with the Guardians of the Galaxy to defeat him. That's a good solicit. That's a nice hook. And it kind of fits the overall story arc, but not really this issue at all, because Thanos and the Avengers never really directly cross paths here. And a little at the end or whatever, maybe, but even that's questionable. So, as a part of a larger whole, this is not a bad issue. As far as a satisfying issue in and of itself, it really left me a bit wanting. Part of this goes down to, pardon the term, decompression, because both the airlock and the story had that. This is not one of the things that is Bendis' best writing. You know, the art by Bagley is what you would expect. It's solid, it's good, it tells an energetic story, but some of the stuff just took too long to do. They pull out a pretty harsh way to treat there to deal with the Badoon ship and so forth. And then try to end on I don't say a cliffhanger, but a plot point of, oh, and this is what's next kind of a deal. You know, big splash page ending for almost the sake of doing that. To me, this is a, frankly, an average comic. It's not horrible. It's not great. It hit a couple of the wrong buttons for me, but I think other people are going to be happy with this. I would give it basically a 3 out of 5 rating. I would have liked to have given it more. I think it's nice to have an Avengers book that's not, again, part and parcel of the huge epic event that they're telling these days. But this didn't quite do that for me. Yeah, you have anything you want to add?
No, I mean, other than you made the statement about it kind of being off on you didn't know exactly how it fit in to the other Avengers continuity. Now, you're reading all the Avengers books. I mean, you read a lot of books, so it's good to get your context on this for both myself and the listeners. You know, because I pick up this book off the rack, couple of months ago. I've been getting the last few issues. And it feels somewhat more accessible, I will say. It feels a lot more accessible to me than the standard Avengers books. It feels like it's an Avengers story going along that's not part of, you know, six or seven different books. It's not pulled into this AVX business. You know, it's not Avengers, New Avengers, Secret Avengers, all these kind of Thunderbolt, Dark Avengers, you know, all these kind of things. It just doesn't have the kind of feel that those books have. It feels more like it's its own thing. It felt to me like, hey, I can pick this up and read it and not feel like I have to read, you know, six other books to figure out what the heck is going on.
Well, it's old school in that respect, in terms of back when titles were more self-contained and had to stand on their own. This reads more like the Avengers title back around the 200-300 era, you know, issue era, when it was just, or even earlier, there's an Avengers book. This is where you read Avengers stories. You may touch on stuff elsewhere from the Marvel Universe, but you don't have to go read 15 other titles to get the full story.
Mm-hmm.
And that's very intentional with what they're doing here to keep it accessible. And the implication is this story takes place pre-Avengers versus X-Men. Now, what happens at the end of the story when they move on to the next arc, I have no idea. We'll see. I just think that they're trying to, again, have their cake and eat it too. They want to tell the big massive crossover stuff in the other Avenger books. They want to have some things where they can say, yeah, we're doing a standalone kind of a thing. I just wish that the pacing on this had been a bit tighter, and it felt like they had done more than just recover from the cliffhanger at the end of the last issue. Because really, that's all the Avengers accomplished this issue for the most part.
Yeah, I mean, pacing, I mean, I haven't read it, but I mean, it sounds like, I'm not surprised.
It's a Bendis book, of course you're not surprised.
It sounds like Bendis pacing, right?
Yes. Classic Bendis pacing. And that's why I think it's good for him to be kind of moving off, you know, the lead position at Marvel, if you will, in terms of story direction and whatnot. And hopefully the people coming in to take over the direction of the Marvel Universe will pick up the pace on stuff, tighten things up a bit, and move forward. But we'll see. Maybe they will, maybe they won't, maybe they'll go too fast, maybe I'll be unhappy for some other reason. But it's time for Bendis to hand over the reins and, you know, see what the next group can do.
Okay.
Shall we move on to our other book, which is X-O Man of War number 5?
X-O Man of War number 5. I've really been liking the Valiant books. X-O, for me, picked up quite a lot after the first issue, which I thought the pacing was a little slow on. I enjoyed this issue. I like how they introduced Ninjak. I liked the character of Ninjak, and it makes sense in the context of the story to have him come into this story the way he did. What I was a little puzzled by in this issue was why Arik would fly to Peru. I didn't get the connection. I mean, he's in northern Italy, and he scans in and he finds his sword, you know, or a sword, you know, kind of buried in the ground. And, you know, he talks to the little girl, army comes up, and then the next page, Peru, headwaters of the Amazon River. You know, it's like, what?
The impression I got was he was kind of, and this was between panels, of course, kind of wandering. He flew off from that first place, like you said, over in Italy. Probably didn't realize how far up he had gone or how far he had traveled. It's just, let's go somewhere else.
Yeah, I got that. I just thought that having a panel or two that made that transition clear would have been useful.
Or simply,
or
if they had, yeah. Or if they had just gotten rid of the Peru headwaters of the Amazon River captions, if it was just soon after and he's landing near a waterfall.
Yeah.
Then the complaint would have been, but they don't have those in Italy. You know, it's, to me, that was a non-issue. I mean, we've established he can fly pretty far, pretty fast. So I really didn't care. As for this title and the slow burn aspect, I think it's still got a little of that here. You know, we're 5 issues in and we really don't have any sense of, you know, a status quo for this character yet. And it may be a while before we get that. Whereas on the other books, while the status quo was evolving, I feel like we've gotten a sense of that. Exo has no home base yet of any sort. And really, I thought the key character in this issue was not really Exo, but Ninjak. And I thought, like you said, they did a great job making him fit into this book as to why bring him in, what's he getting used for, etc. And they did a really good job setting up the character. And to me, he was really the star of this issue.
I like how they're fleshing out the Vine characters and their operatives also.
Yeah.
They're doing a good job on that. This is a really good book. This is the kind of book that if people are skipping the entirety of Valiant or most of Valiant or, you know, things, they shouldn't be, because they're telling some really credible stories here that are very entertaining, and they don't have a lot of necessary back reading or backstory for him. I mean, there is no requirement whatsoever to have read or even known that the previous existence of Valiant was around in order to read and enjoy these books from the beginning.
And it's interesting because I completely agree with that, yet they're still being very respectful of that past. And if you liked the original Exo, you should like this. If you like the original Ninjak, you should like this. It's not the same, but it's not a, hey, they got it all wrong, let's redo it right kind of attitude either.
No, that's a really good point, because what Marvel did with the cross-gen books, for instance, you know, I felt, except for Ruse, which, you know, Wade did and pretty much picked up, you know, the other two books, Sigil and Mystic, I just thought they, for the most part, tossed out everything, or most everything, from the previous existence and kind of redid it from the ground up. And this one, while it's new and different and you didn't need to have read the other stuff, as you say, I don't feel like they are dismissive of, or, you know, that I read the previous ones and I appreciate the updating and I like these stories, and I don't feel like they're just, you know, blowing off the entirety of the other run. While it's not referenced or needed at all, it's, you know, it's just respectful. It's very well done.
I'm curious what we would think of these titles had we recently read the original Valiant stuff, if we would be feeling that this is hitting too many of the same story beats and is too repetitive or not. Because there are aspects here that we have seen things like this before, but it's been, for me, 20 years since I've read really most of Exo, Ninjak, Archer and Armstrong, Time Walker, those other books that they're kind of, you know, picking up the characters with. And I know when I was reading some of the stuff they've been doing, like in Blue Beetle, where it felt like they were almost retelling key aspects of the previous series from 5-6 years ago, a little too soon, too repetitive. When DC kind of restarted the Legion at one point after, I guess, Zero Hour, and they were telling some of the almost iconic stories of the Legion. It's like, yeah, I've seen this road get paved before. I'm not feeling that way here with Valiant, but I'm wondering if that's simply because I don't have a clear enough memory of what they had done the first time around.
I don't know. I haven't read those books in a really long time either, although I think I went back and reread some of them.
We did Solar for like a back issue spotlight.
And I picked up my trade of the old Harbinger stuff and the old Exo stuff, you know, that I have on a shelf here. And I read those within the last year or so, reread them. So, I mean, it wasn't like it's been 20 years for me. But again, I think those old stories stand on their own and were good stories. And the current stuff stands on its own and is good stories also.
I completely agree with that. My question was more what they're doing with the Vine. How much have they done something like that before? Things like that.
Yeah, I think that's a little different because they – I don't remember if they called it the Vine before, but they were always – at least Arik always called them the spider aliens. Or something like that.
Whether you call them the spider aliens, whether they call themselves the Vine.
Right.
Had they infiltrated humanity? Did they have people in major positions of power? You know, is this something that, and I honestly don't remember. Is that something really new with this, or is that something that they're, you know, again, trying to stay true to the original? Because what they're telling here doesn't feel repetitive or redundant, and it's working very well. And again, I think they've really managed to walk that tightrope of how can we tell good, current, modern stories on characters that really were at their heyday 20 years ago, be respectful to that, but not be redundant to that. And they're doing it. They're doing it great.
Yeah, I mean, they got it right. I will say that. They are doing an update of a kind of defunct line, if you will, the right way.
Now, go to the center staple, flip one more page further back in the book, and the last couple of panels before we get to London. Ninjak has two aspects of his current assignment, and the way he handles the second half, I thought, was something that, frankly, was done tastefully. You know, he's decapitating a guy, but not in a, ooh, let's do it the goriest manner possible or whatever. It's clear what's happening, yet not in a, oh my God, that's disgusting kind of a way, if you know what I mean.
Mm-hmm.
And I appreciate that they're doing that. They're trying to tell the story, I'm trying to think what's the best way to phrase this, both tastefully and artfully, but, you know, discreetly, yet clearly, versus let's just go for the blatant, you know, sword, you know, ripping through the head kind of crap or what have you.
Right. Yeah, so. I agree. I mean, they could have gone the really on panel, you know.
They could have gone for the
showing,
shock.
You know, showing the blade slicing through the neck and blood all over the place and the head flying off. And I almost feel like had DC done it, they would have done it that way because they're pretty graphic a lot of times.
If it had been over an Avatar.
Well, Avatar would have... They wouldn't have just cut his head out. They would have disemboweled him on panel and done all other kinds of horrible things.
Again, no, overall...
It was tastefully done.
Yeah. I like this. I liked the fight between Ninjak and Exo. I thought that played out well and, you know, was a good character moment for Ninjak also. You know, While I think there's a little bit of a slow burn aspect still to this title, I really feel they deliver a decent amount of story per issue. I think that's true of pretty much, well, really of everything over at Valiant. And if readers aren't checking that publisher out, they're missing some really good stuff. And I feel comfortable really recommending any of the titles over there.
Mm-hmm.
They're good. They're fun. I like them. So for me, 4 out of 5.
Yeah, a very solid 4 out of 5 for me also. It's a really well done book. I appreciate, like I said, everything that Valiant is doing here. It's just it's how a relaunch of a universe should be done.
Yes. Yeah. Slow and steady, introduce a title at a time. Don't, you know, cross them over and intertwine them into a mess, each one standing on its own.
I like the Ninjak's being brought in here instead of them just blasting out a Ninjak title. You know, to do Ninjak.
Mm-hmm.
You know, keep it, you know.
Yeah, based on this, I'd like to read
to
a Ninjak title.
I know they want a lot more titles, right? But doing it a little slower, that's appreciated.
Yeah. And based on this, would you pick up a Ninjak title?
Probably yes.
Yeah. And to me, that's the way to launch the title, is get the interest first. You know, now if we get a Ninjak title, we know what to expect. Whereas if this had been the first issue of a new Ninjak title of, oh, he's going after Exo or whatever, and Exo was the crossover into his book, people might get it. People might say, you know, I'm going to get off Exo because of that. So they're doing the right things.
I'll also say I like the way that they've been introducing some of the new books. Like at the end of this book, they've got I got 2, 4, 6 pages of the first issue of Shadow Man.
Mm-hmm.
And I read them because, I mean, I'm going to read Shadow Man when it comes out, but I figured, oh, let me read these pages and see. I thought it was really well done. I thought it was a great set of pages. And that, even if I had not pre-ordered Shadow Man, reading those 6 pages has me saying, wow, that looks really good. I want to get Shadow Man when it comes out. I think that's a really good way to introduce a new title by putting the preview pages in like that so someone can read, get a feel for it. The downside for some publishers there is they have to be really good. It has to be good art and good writing, which this was. I think another thing that Valiant is doing is they're exercising some good judgment and I don't think discretion is the right word, but I mean, they're picking good creative teams that seem to have a good voice for and a good good take on these characters.
Yeah, yeah. Well, and again, as for the backup, preview of upcoming books, what was it over at Marvel? Was it Howling Commandos at one point a couple of years ago? They had that in like every Marvel book, and those pages were horrible.
Yeah, it was like I look at those pages and it actively made me not want to buy the book, which is kind of not what somebody would want to have happen, right? So
yeah, but again, like you said, Valiant is taking their time on this. They're picking good creative teams that fit the properties and, getting the best stories out of them that they seem to be able to get, and the quality is on the page. And that's as much a matter of the creative team as the editorial team being able to facilitate that process. So, I'm looking forward to seeing how the Valiant universe grows, how well they can keep it as a consistent universe without necessarily overly intertwining all the books, if they keep it to a nice manageable size. I mean, to me, 8 to 10 titles, I think, is kind of the optimal size for a publisher at that size. Enough that you can be leveraging the overhead of the office staff, the editorial staff, the letterers, the people who can work kind of faster on multiple books, get some momentum, have 2 or 3 books a week, but that's it, and have something every week. I think once you're below 4 or 5 titles and you don't have something every week, that's not as advantageous. I don't think you've got kind of that economy of scale for certain aspects. And I certainly think that even with the number of books they have out now, having one a week just builds up some weekly momentum. There's always a reason to go to the store and get a Valiant book. And they're not quite there yet because some of their books are shipping on the same week.
Yeah. I think as they get, to a steady state and they get, 5 or 6 books out, then it'll be a little easier to get that happening.
Yeah. But they're doing great stuff.
Yeah. They're so far, they're getting into that, my favorite, I guess, small publisher of the year. Once I kind of go out of the, the top ranks, I still like Image and what they're doing. But as far as it goes, as far as small publisher, or even new publisher, they definitely have that going for them. I mean, they're doing an excellent job.
Yeah, I mean, they're squarely on my publishers to watch list.
And they're in the great position where, so far, they get the absolute benefit of the doubt. Anything that they put out, I will try, because they have not disappointed me yet.
Yeah, it's not that they can do no wrong, it's that they have done no wrong yet.
Right.
They haven't burned us or yeah.
Right. It's just I see something new from them and I say, okay, they've been doing a lot of good stuff. They've been exercising some good judgment, and it's just something that I'm on board for what they're dishing up.
Yeah, I would agree with that. I'm in sync with the people they've got greenlighting the books, and I'm happy with the quality. So what else have you had time to read?
I read through some Zero issues. I read through Demon Knights Zero. It was okay.
It was good for the demon, less so for the knights.
Yeah, I mean it was the demon origin story, fine. I really felt like it was more of a needless interruption to the cliffhanger we had in the last issue than anything else.
Mm-hmm.
Green Lantern Corps, I really liked the Guy Gardner story. It gave some background context to Guy that I thought was really well done. That was my favorite of the lot. And then I read Resurrection Man number 0, and I think that one tied off the storyline, you know, in a good way. But it was also the direction that title had been going for the last few issues. I can't say that I'm that terribly sorry to see it go.
I think they did, like you said, an excellent job kind of closing off the title cleanly. This 0 issue was just the next issue in the storyline, so it's not like they were, you know, shoehorning in an origin story. And that origin story, like you said, organically kind of closed off this series. I hope we see the character again. The fact that he's losing his title, yeah, I'm okay with that. Did you read The Shade?
No, I have not been reading The Shade.
Because we got the final issue of that, and to me it's the direct counterpoint to Resurrection Man, because we get his origin in here too, yet it felt like it was just an awkward place to end the series with.
Was it a 0 issue, or was it issue 12?
It was issue 12. And I almost would have given it a 0 issue and then a 12 to cleanly close off the story. It was something about it that just didn't work for me. It was not a bad issue. I mean, it's James Robinson. It just felt out of place and not what I was expecting for the last issue, and not something that felt like a last issue, I guess is what I'm trying to say. I also read Incredible Hulk number 13. I'm really enjoying what they're doing right now in that book. They're doing some good stuff there. We've got at least issue 14 coming out probably in about 2 weeks' time. I don't know how many more issues of that before they restart that with Indestructible Hulk.
I read Fantastic Four 610. I liked that one more than I liked the last issue, which we reviewed.
Mm-hmm.
I'm looking forward to seeing how they close. It's actually kind of an interesting thing with, you know, AIM Island and all that. I really don't. It sounds like something I'd like to see Hickman be able to develop, and knowing that, you know, he's off the book and, you know, they're rebooting everything, and there's a chance that they're really not going to do anything with that. That kind of is like, oh, okay, well, I don't know what to think of that. And then I read Winter Soldier number 10, which, you know, is a good issue, just continuing on with the brainwashed Black Widow storyline.
Yeah. Now, they've got some books they're telling some good stories on, but this is kind of where DC was at a little over a year ago with, you know, with Flashpoint, when it was going on with the, we're getting a new 52 reboot. How much of the stories they're telling now right now at Marvel, how much are they going to matter in a couple of months' time, if at all?
Mm-hmm.
And that's kind of, I think, undercutting the story potential or the impact of some of these stories. I think both of us would have been much more excited about this AIM Island stuff if it was early in Hickman's run versus at the tail end.
Yes, yes, that's true.
Even if it didn't go anywhere, we would have at least figured it might. So, anything else, or does that pretty much do it?
That was all I had a chance to read. I was on East Coast time when I got home last night, so I got a few books read, but not everything.
Fair enough.
Join us next week when we discuss Sword of Sorcery number 0 from DC, Ultimate Comics Ultimates number 15 from Marvel, and Ghost number 0 from Dark Horse Comics.
The show notes and forum for this podcast can be found at www.comicbookpage.com under the podcast and forum sections of the website. Please email us at theguys@comicbookpage.com and let us know what you think of what was discussed in this episode. Thanks for listening.